It's the Mind of the Machine edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, robots in biology, AI, MI, EI, and the role of smart machines in society. Now let's begin episode 138.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword for politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
And welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your freethinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher.
With you again today, Jenna, your biochemist.
And today we have a special guest thinker. Let's introduce Anjong Moon.
Hello.
Did I butcher your name?
No, it's fine. It's Ajung.
Ajung.
Same thing.
I knew it. Ajung, you have a BA in mechatronic engineering.
Yep, mechatronics engineering.
What the heck is mechatronics?
It's
Defender
pretty much,
of Tokyo.
Something like that, but it's more precisely the combination of mechanical engineering, computer science, systems, and electrical. So just combining all of those engineering thoughts together to make something that move mechanically and through electrical powers.
Cool. You're currently, what, working at the Collaborative Advanced Robotics and Intelligent Systems Lab here at UBC?
Yep, I am. I'm currently a master's student here and trying to finish up right now.
You have a current thesis you're working on, which is?
It's on a topic of nonverbal communications with a robot. So it's in the field of human-robot interaction and robotics, and we can talk more about that later.
Cool. Speaking of robots and humans.
So, guys, robots, we might as well just finish the show here, because apparently we have already reached the singularity, the robots have taken over, we are obsolete. And I'm using a single metric to determine this. The fact that the record for how fast a Rubik's Cube can be solved has now been beaten by a robot.
No.
Oh, yes. So a robot named Storm Cube 2, who is made of Lego, which, as we know, is a much better material than any of us have made of, and powered by an Android smartphone, made a new world record for the colorful puzzle. So any guesses on how fast the robot could do this? Ajung, do you have any idea?
I guess an hour, because I haven't been able to solve it yet.
Wow. So I'll give you a hint that the previous record holder was Felix Zemdegs, whose name I almost certainly butchered, who's a human, and he did in 5.66 seconds.
Wow.
I know. I can't even, like, that sort of blows my mind. I think he should be breeding up a storm. But the robot...
yes, no. As far as evolutionary goes, one's abilities to solve Rubik's Cubes definitely gives you an advantage as far as, you know, procreating the future generation.
Oh, dude, in a bar, I'd so be going home with that guy. But the computer managed to do it in 5.352 seconds, which also makes me wonder how they were actually defining the endpoints of the experiments to get 3 decimal points on the seconds for how fast the Rubik's Cube could actually be solved. But in any case, I don't think Storm Cube 2... was peeling off the stickers, and I think this was legit and actually...
That's allowable, isn't it?
I mean, can you peel off the stickers in 5.352 seconds?
No, but if they're off ahead of time, I bet you I could put... No, I probably couldn't do that.
So I'm not exactly clear on the ethical implications of Rubik's Cube solvation, but maybe we'll get into that a little bit later in the show.
I'm curious, sorry. So this, they actually had a mechanical robot spinning the cubes, right?
You betcha.
So isn't part of its slowness just literally the mechanics of it, that if it had was solving it... I'm distinguishing here between the intelligence of solving the Rubik's Cubes and the engineering of having fingers spin things.
You know what? I actually wonder that about the human aspect as well. Like, how much of that 5.32 or whatever the heck ridiculous time that the, or 5.66 seconds that the human was able to do it in, how much of that actually has to do with physical dexterity rather than mental acuity? I have no idea.
Well, you know, there is a set formula for solving a Rubik's Cube. You don't even really have to know what they are. If you just know, turn it a certain way enough times, you're eventually going to solve it. Huh. So
maybe it's mostly dexterity to just do it real fast.
Possibly, yes.
On the other hand, it looked like this robot was actually, like, there was an algorithm that was written for the Android smartphone, not to do it in a specific way over and over again, but rather to actually pay attention to where the colors were.
Yeah, because I was going to say, you know, I mean, if you have 1,000 monkeys and typewriters, I mean, eventually anything. So you could spin the Rubik's Cube, and I imagine eventually, just by random chance, it'd be solved.
Oh, yeah.
But might take the end of time, but... No, yeah. I know. I have my little book, too, I bought. I bought the book.
Okay.
Well, actually, coincidentally, this morning when I was watching the news, there was some guy who managed to do it while juggling two other Rubik's Cubes to solve one with one hand. So the lady on the news called him a show-off, and I'm inclined to believe her.
Yeah. Well, nice to know that there's a wide, you know, birth of ways that we can solve Rubik's Cubes that robots currently haven't overtaken. So.
Absolutely.
You know, and actually that is one of the interfaces in a way, isn't it? I mean, you have a machine that's trying to emulate a human in its capacities, and that's interesting.
Well then, let's get on with today's show, all about robots. And Jenna, you're going to tell us a bit about biomimetic robots.
So yeah, so the area of biomimetics, and you can correct me if I have misinterpreted the entire area of study, but is pretty much what it sounds like. So it's mimicking biology. So these principles are used extensively for many types of engineering problems and are now an area of very prolific research in robotics. So it's also a really logical way to go if you think about the way that evolution works through natural selection. So through natural biological evolution, the physical traits that are best suited to perform a specific task emerge and are then refined. So this means that these traits have had hundreds of thousands of years of improvements. And us lowly humans, by borrowing the physical strategies that we observe in nature, are basically hijacking hundreds of thousands of years of evolutionary innovation. So luckily for us, nature's patent lawyers really suck. So, a lot of the time, the goal of biomimetic research is to find out how to make the stuff we want to create better by using strategies that we find in nature. Insects are often used as biomimetic models in robotics because their basic body plan and exoskeleton make their traits particularly amenable to robotic copying through metal parts. So this is the case for the robot Dash. And this is modeled off of the cockroach, and it's designed as a tough, all-terrain, scampering robot that can go where it's too cramped or dangerous for humans to go, such as collapsed buildings. So what the researchers who created Dash maybe didn't expect, however, was for this metal critter to provide some real insight into evolutionary biology. So to solve some of the balance problems that Dash was having in its clambering activities, the researchers added flapping wings and a tail fin from a toy airplane. I should mention that this robot is made from sort of found materials or cheap, highly available materials. It's one of its things.
So is it one of those things where a tornado goes through a junkyard and assembles an airplane complete, right?
Is this one of those questions I'm supposed to answer seriously?
Yeah, no, just another shot. You intelligent design people want to...
So, interestingly, adding the wings, these flapping wings, help the running ability of Dash really dramatically. So the degree of the slope that the robot was able to handle was greatly increased, both up and down, and the speed of the electronics creeper's scuttle almost doubled. So these improvements are pretty impressive in and of themselves, but they are also a test of some theories in the evolution of flight that before had only been supported by a scant fossil record. So the researchers that were experimenting with Dash didn't go out to test biology, but then some evolutionary biologists got interested in the results of what they saw as a test of their theories. So in the field of the evolutionary biology, the evolution of flight, The computer models had suggested that for biological scamperers, such as, you know, small forest creatures, they would need to triple their running speed to be able to achieve flight. But Dash's wings doubled the speed, but fell short of the tripling. And so the experiment actually provides some evidence for the theory of flight evolution that suggests that flight started as gliding in tree-dwelling creatures rather than from land-based animals requiring a takeoff speed. So obviously, this is not conclusive, as there are tons of variables in the situation, but it's interesting and partially accidental experiment nonetheless.
It shows another interesting thing, too. Evolutionarily speaking, right, and most people know that birds have evolved from dinosaurs, and birds are dinosaurs of a form. But that the feathers evolved long before flight ever did. And there's always been sort of, well, why would you evolve feathers? I mean, some people say, well, maybe it's to keep them warm. Maybe it's a, you know, sexual sort of trait. But you're making it implied that you could have sort of this rudimentary feathers just if you live in hilly terrain or something, and it would dramatically be an advantage for you.
Even a development of a flapping mechanism, like with the developed pectoral muscles and that kind of thing to enable that physical motion, is really helping the athletic performance in areas other than flight.
And to hit this nail again, which also shows, too, that a lot of evolutionary solutions aren't prefab. It's not like, boom, we have flight.
No.
There's a long sort of tweak, 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 tweak until
we
get the end product.
And not toward a specific goal either.
Exactly.
We should always remember the random nature of the sort of mutations that happen, that because they have an advantage. So how did wings that function in flight develop? Well, before they had flight, they still had to provide an advantage, and that advantage looks like it was increased running speed and sort of agility. So it's really interesting to think that while we use nature as a model in biomimetics to create things in science, that the very things we create can actually be used to model nature. It's sort of like an interesting turnaround.
Yeah, no, actually, and I like the idea that, I mean, we have these engineering issues, and we often, without even thinking about it, are taking an evolutionary approach to solving them. I mean, like, again, the robot you're talking about, the car we have, is actually been evolving over time. And we don't think of cars as an evolving entity because they're made, but, I mean, they do have a path of evolution, not directed even. Oh, come on.
Well, I think it's probably a good idea to go to a short break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back to talk more about robots with our guest when we come back.
This is Phil Plait of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
2011 marks the 25th anniversary of the Dr. Sun Yat-sen Chinese Garden since opening in 1986. The Dr. Sun Yat-sen Chinese Garden is very pleased to have been able to connect cultures and communities for the past 25 years and continue being an arts and cultural hub in the neighborhood and the city. Watch for complimentary specials on the 25th day of every month. There are also blockbuster exhibits, community events, academic conferences, and music and theater productions lined up, plus contests and giveaways. CITR 101.9 FM is proud to be a year-long partner as the Garden celebrates its 25th anniversary. For more information, visit www.vancouverchinesegarden.com.
Show your Friends of CITR card or simply mention that you heard about the garden on CITR to receive $2 off admission.
In the sky, standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck. I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello, and we're back. So now we're going to go into sort of an extended discussion here about the good, the bad, and the ugly of smart machines. Machines are increasingly becoming an integral part of our lives. Most of them, to an ever-increasing degree, are becoming more and more intelligent. Be it the new iPhone with its predictive voice recognition or the light that turns itself off when you leave the room. Often, the smartest thing in the room might not be you. We're going to cover three main areas of the idea of intelligence relating to the non-biological. First one up is the idea of artificial intelligence, your classic computer program achieving consciousness. If you want an example of AI in this sense, think of something like Skynet from Terminator, Data from Star Trek, or Andrew from The Positronic Man. Anyone who likes Isaac Asimov will remember that one. The issue often arises with these sort of things is the idea of human rights and that sort of thing. AI is a philosophical problem, huge philosophical problem, because in a large degree, we don't really understand what the concept of consciousness is in itself. I mean, there's some elements that seem to count, others that don't. One of the main ones is this whole idea of being self-aware, that, you know, the most important thing about consciousness is I know that I exist independent of the world around me. But if we expand it to that, I mean, one, most robotic systems, artificial intelligence systems, know that I am Z4381 and this is my location in this matrix of stuff.
Do most biological organisms know that?
No, actually, almost all biological organisms don't. There are a few exceptions. Monkeys seem to, chimpanzees seem to know it, great apes. Most primates can distinguish themselves from the other. And I guess by the other, the classic example is you take a mirror, yeah, and you take your subject and you put a dot on the forehead of the subject. The subject looks in the mirror, sees the dot, and the idea, if you are self-aware, you know, hey, that's a reflection of me. It's just not another thing out there. Mm-hmm. And you go and you pick the dot off your forehead or you investigate what the heck it is.
If I was testing animals, I'd use food.
Okay. Actually, no, these dots.
Or small children, I'd use food.
Okay. Are you saying small children are animals?
Well, by definition, yes.
Okay. But no, and they've done this like with dolphins and all that, right? I think even elephants and horses qualify in some senses for this sort of test. So it seems to be a bit of a hodgepodge as to what qualifies as self-aware. But again, it seems to be one of those criteria that we just assume to be self-aware.
So, but this is related to consciousness rather than intelligence. I'm wondering if we can maybe get a reasonable definition of artificial intelligence to start off this discussion.
No.
Okay.
Again, that's one of the...
Maybe our guest has an opinion on this one.
Well, I'm kind of inclined to say that, like you mentioned, we don't really have an understanding of consciousness. And I guess the philosophy behind artificial intelligence is that you would, at the end of the day, achieve some kind of artificial being. But it's essentially, I'm assuming you're going to talk about machine intelligence afterwards. It's actually the same kind of technically methods, but different philosophies in how people look at, oh, okay, can we achieve consciousness or these higher level thinking in artificial beings, as opposed to let's solve this engineering problem with this method, computer science-y methods that we have, which we kind of combine as machine intelligence, artificial intelligence.
Cool. On that sort of related note with the idea of consciousness, another aspect besides the idea of being self-aware and all that is also the idea of creativity, that, you know, you can come up with a solution having never seen this problem before. And that's another thing that seems to be the idea of non-linear thinking is, you know, mm-hmm. just create something out of the blue. Which, again, you know, we don't understand how this works in humans, and it seems hard to know how we would model something like that in computers. Do we do anything like that in computers?
I am aware of computer programs that are able to paint creatively, or so-called, quote-unquote, creatively. But I'm not sure if I'll call that creativeness. It's more like the probabilities that we play around with the different colors and the pixels that make images that tend to be beautiful.
Has anyone here seen the episode of Star Trek The Next Generation, A Measure of a Man, where Data is put on sort of trial to see if he is property of Starfleet or an individual with rights and all that jazz?
Yes.
Well, anyway, that episode basically touches on everything that we've been talking about. And at one point, they say, well, prove that a normal human being is conscious, self-aware, and has free will. And of course, they're like, well, he's a robot. You know, it's like, well, okay, but if he's self-aware, and he paints, and he thinks, and he knows what's going on...
And it's a he?
Well, he... Yes. I think he is anatomically correct.
Yeah, no, they did make... That was a big thing in one of the episodes, that he was fully functional, quote-unquote, in that, because he had a girlfriend for one of...
Well, By fully functional, like, can he genetically propagate?
He did create an android of his own that he called his daughter.
Yeah.
Aww.
And he can go through the motions, because, again, that's in the X-rated version of Star Trek.
Hey, that's mostly the important part.
He had a fling with one of the crew members, and then, like, in a later episode, he actually tried to have a relationship, and that was humorous, because he couldn't feel the emotion, so he was just, like, reading books and acting a certain way.
Well, and actually, they took this whole idea one step further in Star Trek Voyager, and where they have the holographic doctor on the show, right? Who although never does pick a name, becomes a fully functional sort of human. He has romantic relationships with other holographic entities and non-holographic entities at one point, but I don't know how that happened. But actually, their version of that, does it have rights or not, was the doctor had created a novel. He wrote his own novel from scratch about his adventures, right? And someone took it and then didn't want to give him credit, didn't want to acknowledge his rights, and he sort of went to court for it. And they said, well, you're just a machine. You have no rights. Machines have no rights. And again, that's where the whole idea of artificial intelligence, in the stronger sense of the term, if it thinks, it acts, it talks like a human being, so to speak, then at what point do we say, no, you don't have any rights, or because you're not made of flesh and blood?
Well, I think that kind of falls under what you define as a machine, right? Because nowadays we have these machines, quote-unquote, again, that are interfacing with biological beings. So we have insects with their brains being hooked up to these probes, electrical probes, and then being controlled by these electronic components. So it's, we've got these cyborg solutions to approaching mechanical problems, but do we call them machines or now bugs? So if you were to kind of think about that kind of machines, but extend it further into our imagination, like a human-like cyborg, then I guess the rights question would be very, very challenging. But if it's just a mechanical part with a very high level of intelligence in the way we determine it right now, which is computer programs, then I don't want to give it rights.
But you see, this is where it becomes somewhat, I guess, speciesist, or actually, I'm not sure that, I think it's a broader term here. Is if you have a number of people, and I'm going to, in this case, put people in quotes, who are biologically human, but for one reason or another have no brain, or are as far as their intellectual capacity, it's gone. Either be they brain dead, be they some form of genetic malfunction when they were born. So in one sense, the only reason why we've gifted them human rights is because they have come from humans, which, I mean, don't get me wrong, that's not a bad example. But it seems very, suddenly we've become very arbitrary, that a machine, no matter what it does, will never be able to cross that threshold, because until it comes out of a human, it just doesn't seem to quite qualify.
Well, and not necessarily even a human. I mean, if we think of the kinds of rights that we do bestow on even creatures with a lot of even lower cognitive capacity, and the kind of ethical issues and stuff that you have, even doing experiments on certain types of invertebrates and stuff, and it sort of calls into question, like, how smart does an artificial being have to be before we recognize any sort of rights? Because if you think of the types of rights that you might give a baby mouse in a scientific experiment, what kind of rights are you denying, even that level of rights, to a robot that is able to closely emulate some human behaviors?
I don't know.
Just something to think about.
Well, so this is sort of, machines become intelligent, and that somehow seems like a positive thing, but there's sort of a flip side to that. So artificial intelligence, I'm sort of putting it in a little box, saying, well, it's sort of a consciousness. It is self-aware. It is whatever that is. But there's another aspect that's often referred to as machine intelligence. Now, these are not the idea of self-aware or anything, but they're really, really, really smart machines. They don't need to be self-aware.
And by smart, we mean good at what they do?
Exactly. So if you think about it, something like Deep Blue, which beat the world's best chess player.
Awesome.
Watson, who cleaned up in Jeopardy.
And don't forget CubeStorm 2. He's got that Rubik's Cube totally cased.
See, I was going to use Brave because it seemed more salient.
Sorry.
Well, actually, no. It's one of four self-driving vehicles that won an international intercontinental race. So these are robots, machines, that are smart enough.
You know what? They totally had an advantage. They had no navigator to bitch at.
Well, and then, of course, another area of this that we're aware of almost every day is drone planes. Right,
yep.
We hear pioneered by Israel, but one of the mainstays now, the American military. Now, you know, this goes into, well, what sort of responsibilities do machines have? So, you know, one, we say, do they own rights? But are there any ethical criteria we need to apply to them? So, I mean, Isaac Asimov had his famous, you know, three rules of robotics, right? And for those who don't know them, a robot may not injure a human being either through inaction or action. A robot must obey the orders given by human unless it conflicts with the first law. And three, the robot must protect its own existence unless it conflicts with the first two laws. Now, in a modern context, something like a drone, and although there's many other examples you could use, they kill people every day, hundreds of people. And I think right now we can kind of assume the moral responsibility lays at the feet of either the people who built it or the people who are using it, and that's a discussion in itself. But at some point, these machines are going to become more or less self-directed, not self-aware necessarily, but really good at their job. And at what point do we say, well, this machine malfunctioned, this machine did something and it is responsible for these deaths and we should punish the machine somehow? Which leads into a whole interest. How do you punish a machine?
Decommission it?
Well, so you execute it.
I suppose you could do that.
No.
But don't drones explode after they've been used?
No.
Oh, okay.
No. And there are actually various types of drones, so before anyone flies into us.
apparently this show is way more popular than I thought.
So I'm not referring so much to the drones that are remotely flown, because there are some that are drones, but there's actual piloting in them.
I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that's called human in the loop.
Yeah. But there are some that are out there that are human out of the loop, and those are becoming...
Or on the loop.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Good, no, that's a good point.
I think.
Yeah.
You're right, yeah. We just call it teleoperated if there's somebody behind playing with a joystick and operating the machine. But
good.
Same idea.
So what do you guys think about, I mean, do machines ever become morally responsible for their deeds, or is it always up to whoever made it? And let's say a machine becomes conscious. Is it still morally responsible for its actions, and how do you punish it?
Well, there's a scientist Ryan Kahlo from Stanford. He studies law on robotics tips issues, and he was mentioning how just because it's manufactured by somebody, a robotic product is produced by this particular person, doesn't mean that the person has the responsibility over that as a manufacturer in the same sense as dryer or washing machine or anything like that, partially because some of these robots come with the type of artificial intelligence which kind of learns from its environment. And in a sense, you know, somebody programming these robots, you don't really know what it's going to learn and how it's going to end up behaving at the end of the day. So in that sense, that is a really a big challenge from the legal aspect of things. Who is liable when things go wrong?
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, and sort of to the side of that, I've definitely heard suggestions that, especially in cases of war and whatnot, where when you think of the ethics of war, they're kind of arbitrary to begin with. It's sort of what we've decided. And there is more or less an algorithm to follow when you think of the Geneva Conventions and whatnot, where there ideally isn't much subjective gray zone to be considered. Don's giving me strange looks, but I'm generalizing. So, but the point is that the sort of intrinsic moral responsibilities of humans sometimes come to override the laws that we have created for that type of atmosphere, and that something that is more algorithmically based than human consciousness would actually be able to act in a more legally considered moral way in those types of situations.
You know, in many ways, I think I would agree with you. Although, of course, thanks to people like George Washington, the Geneva Convention doesn't really exist anymore, but we won't go down that
road. I was talking idealized situations, especially where the laws are, you know, carefully written.
But I wonder if there's any insight that could be perceived into this, because, I mean, in one sort of sense, we already have an artificial entity out there that is responsible, in quotes, for deaths, harm, injury, and we call them corporations, right? These are legal entities. They are considered people under the law. For example, BP, you know, when it had its big explosion, was BP, full caps, responsible? Well, I guess it wasn't full caps. Was it morally responsible as a corporation, or was the CEO personally responsible? And in the same sense that you have, we'll pick on the poor drones because they're easy targets to...
Poor drones.
Yeah. Is Northrop Grumman responsible for creating an entity that ultimately was going to wind up in someone... Or you knew it was going to kill someone eventually. Is it the U.S. military because they're the ones who bought it and actually put it to that purpose? Or is it the drone itself because it was the actual mechanism of death? BP, just to continue my thing, right? BP bought the equipment from a manufacturer, right? It was owned or operated by the CEOs and chairman of the board, so they're the ones who make the actual decisions. But BP itself was sort of the entity that was physically responsible for the damage that was done. And how do we parse that sort of difference? I mean, I've never seen a corporation yet go to jail. Or even executed for Ethan's solution for anything that goes
but
wrong.
But call out to all cartoonists, because I think we need some kind of virtual execution of corporations.
Actually, Arizona has a law that if a corporation violates a number of laws, I forget the number of laws, it loses its business license.
Which by hanging?
Using your business license essentially means you're killed, because for a corporation without a business license, it no longer exists. Just like zapping a robot's brain, I guess, would mean it no longer exists. Thoughts?
I believe, from what I've heard, corporations are legally persons in the legal lingo of things, partially because, you know, if a CEO makes a bad decision or whatever and then makes billions of dollars in damage, then the person can't handle the damage. So it's actually the corporation that gets sued, not the CEO or the head of the company. So in the same sense, some people actually, I might be digressing a little bit, but some people actually suggest they suggest that robots may be better off having that kind of corporation-like personhood legally, so that we can try it in court in more of a sensical way.
Possibly not very satisfying for those that are victims of whatever went on.
No, I can see how it worked out. I mean, if a robot did you wrong, let's say an assembly robot at Ford plant or something, right? So we're doing now something that it might be, you know, sentenced to 30 years of servitude. So you'd have a butler in your home who could go around and serve you drinks because that was his penalty for causing you harm because he malfunctioned the car that he built or something.
And notice see, when now you said causing you harm, I was totally picturing sexual assault.
Jenna, this is a family show, Jenna. Let's keep those comments too.
Do any families listen to this show?
Oh, I shouldn't. No.
Well, let's go to a commercial break right now, and we'll come back with more about robots on Radio Freethinker.
You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada.
The state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting, like, more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a crowd. I draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
To subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreeThinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@RadioFreeThinker.com. Empowered you.
We're back on Radio Free Thinker, so, talking about robots.
Well, actually, we're going to be nicer now. We're going to move on to, so we talked about artificial intelligence, you know, the self-aware brain, and we talked sort of about machine intelligence, a really smart computer. Another area of this sort of non-biological intelligence is the idea of emotional intelligence. The ability for a non-biological entity to sort of understand and respond appropriately to emotional situations or stimulus. So you can relax now, Anjan, because we're going to get away from the whole dire, oh my God, the drone's out to kill us all, and talk about, well, this is sort of your area of specialty, isn't it, how humans and robots interact and some of the emotional involvement happens.
Yeah, well, I like to call it more of a social interaction rather than emotional intelligence. Well, a social interaction kind of puts it as an umbrella term to encapsulate the emotional interaction as well. So basically, what I specialize in or do research in is how robots should interact with humans. To kind of start off, you know, back in the days, a couple of decades ago, we got used to the idea of robots being, you know, being in welding lines or whatever in manufacturing, locked in cells so that you don't ever come into contact with them, except for maybe pressing buttons to stop it or start it and stuff like that. Or on the other extreme, we kind of had this imaginary figures from science fiction about robots being Terminator or R2-D2 and being
or anatomically correct emotional beings.
I was going to say robots that are like humans, and then you said R2-D2, and I'm going, well...
sorry. Not so
but,
human.
Yeah, no, but yeah, so we have the fictional versus sort of the reality of it, but both of them are images of what robots are.
Yeah, but in the fictional ones, you kind of tend to see these robots being really immersed naturally into human societies, whereas, you know, the back-in-the-days model of robots are not really, they're kind of secluded from our world a little bit, but... Today, we actually see a lot of robots in our living rooms, like the vacuum cleaner is one, and we have a lot of robotic toys out there. So they are the robots that are actually interacting with us in person. So we come into physical contact with them, and we play with them, and et cetera, et cetera. So what I study is when a person and a robot are sharing the same kind of environment together, the same kind of object, for example, then what should a robot do if it wants to go for the same object as you at the same time as the human? For example, a bowl of chocolate in front of the four of us, and we're all going for the same chocolate at the same time.
Okay, and to just make this more realistic, I have to confess, I am a robot. So I will be the robot also going for the chocolate.
Okay, what would you do?
Well, I would acquiesce to my human masters.
Okay.
I'm bowing now, for those who can.
Well, that's pretty much what happens in the industries. We usually have, for safety reasons, collision avoidance implemented onto the robot, such that the robot doesn't physically punch you in the tummy or whatever for a chocolate or anything like that. So what I am studying is looking at how humans behave in that situation and kind of implementing that humanness of dealing with that tiny bit of conflict of resource scenario into human-robot interaction.
So really you're engineering robots to go, oh no, I insist.
Something like that. So how humans usually behave is we reach for the same thing and realize that the other person is going for the same thing at the same time. So we tend to have this jerky hand motions, that's what I call hesitation gestures, which is our way of being polite to each other and also communicating to the other person what I'm about to do and what I actually want, which is saying, I want the chocolate, but I'm not sure about coming into collision with you. But robots obviously don't do that. So I have been looking at what are the characteristic things that we look at and or pick up in those kind of gestures and in other humans and kind of implementing onto a robot so that the robot can communicate to you what it's about to do.
Sort of like when I go to grab the chocolate, another sort of social cue is I usually look at the robot. I look at the chocolate. So like there's an intentionality to my gaze as well as my hand movements.
Right, and you end up looking at the robot's gesture and kind of understand what the robot is trying to do. So it's the whole idea of increasing the transparency of the robot's state to the human observer or the teammate or collaborator, so that we can actually negotiate a solution about this tiny conflict between humans and robots.
And so you use the word collaborator, and I would assume that this would research would be very applicable in collaborations between humans and robots in different scenarios, because as humans, of course, we do perform so much of our communication non-verbally, right. And if you had to constantly be, robot, I'm going to move my hand to the right now.
Exactly.
Then, or robot, what the hell are you doing? Then it may become a lot more frustrating and difficult to handle even simple tasks than if you had what you're talking about, this nonverbal communication.
Yeah, exactly.
Of course, doesn't that also mean now that robots can inadvertently be very rude? You know, I mean, because sometimes our body language...
be the bird.
No, but sometimes our body language actually can be a miscue. You know, I misread what you meant or what you were trying to do. And, I mean, sort of by default, if a robot do this, robot do that, there's sort of no room for error.
Have you ever sent a text message?
Only with the caps locks on halfway through it. Okay, well, so another area with this, so you know, we're trying to mimic human gestures and that sort of thing, so we get this sort of nonverbal communication going on. But there's actually kind of a big divide in the human interaction community from what I've seen with regards to, and I've just seen these from Japan, so I'm going to call it Japanese camp, where they tend to have very human-like, so it looks very much like a human.
Like
they're trying to mimic it as much as they possibly can visually, whereas you get, and again, just because I saw a thing about Germany, they were doing in Germany, just where they say, well, no, we're not going to make it look like human at all. We're going to make it look lifelike, but it's going to be not human because our expectations from humans are much more detailed than they are from, let's say, a dog. Right? And so it actually makes the interface easier on the one hand, even if it's a little less normal.
Well, and I've heard that described, and maybe you have some insight, as avoiding the uncanny valley effect. And yeah, how you can be really creeped out by things that are human but not quite, and how this can be circumvented by just adopting a form for robotics that might act very human, sort of as human as we can get, but not look like it.
Yeah, so Marie's uncanny valley theory is pretty much that as a machine start to look or feel or behave more like a human, then you kind of get creeped out. But it's the same kind of feeling that he describes as looking at a zombie, you know, or a walking dead. You kind of know that it's a human kind of thing, but it's not supposed
to be.
Not quite,
right.
Not supposed to, yeah. That's the uncanny feeling.
Or the French. Sorry, someone had to say something like that.
Oh, okay. It's kind of funny that you mention it because the Japanese camps that you mentioned, kind of led by Dr. Ishiguro from obviously Japan ATR Lab, he has made a lot of geminoids, or what he calls geminoids, which are pretty much androids, replicas of actual human beings that feel like human, that look like human, and you can actually teleoperate from a computer. And the robots are supposed to mimic what you're doing in interacting with actual humans. And the underlying idea with that is, if we have these kind of human-looking things that may have surpassed the uncanny valley problem, then can we understand what humans actually are? You know, can we actually understand more about ourselves? Going back to our earlier topic.
Yeah, for sure, about trying to understand biology through mimicking it with science.
But his notion is to actually make something that is very, very human-like, whereas a lot of roboticists in the Western side of things, we're happy with the machine-like looking robots, because we do understand that people have the tendency to anthropomorphize these different machines, even computers that doesn't really look like humans at all. We just say, "Oh, I hate this computer," or or things like that. And that's something famously studied by Clifford Nass from Stanford. And by me saying, we don't really need a lot to kind of personify these artifacts. It doesn't have to look like a human being, but obviously having eyes or nose or whatever, they help us in anthropomorphizing it, but not necessarily.
It's so funny hearing you talk about the efforts of these Japanese groups. I get kind of creeped out just thinking about it. talking about how, if you can get past that, you could see how it'd be a really interesting platform to study how we perceive other humans as humans by sort of tweaking different things and seeing what makes that perception break down.
Right.
So if you take away certain abilities, if you add certain behaviors, what's the breaking point? You know, what makes us go, okay, whoa, what the hell are you?
Right.
As opposed to, okay, I accept this thing as same, other instead of other.
Yeah, it's sort of like, again, to use Micro's analogy, the Western camp says, well, we're never going to get it right, so why even try? Whereas this other one says, well, okay, it's not working yet, but the only way to get over the hill is to climb up it.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the interesting things I had heard, and this relates to an article, kind of what you sent me, in Japan, again, sorry, I don't mean to pick on the Japanese, but because they have a growing elderly population and, you know, the number of people who can work like in old folks' homes, that sort of thing, right, to help care for the elderly is becoming fewer and fewer. So they're trying to adopt sort of more mechanical, robotic sort of methods for helping. And one of the side effects they've discovered is actually another number of the people who live there are actually like that better, because they can ask a robot, can you lift me out of bed? Can you help me go to the toilet? Can you help me do this? And there's no shame. There's no I'm being a burden, a hindrance. Whereas if you had a human assistant, there's this like sort of, you know, I hate to bother you, but I need to go do this. Or, you know, it's, oh God, he's looking at me and I don't want him to see me like this. Whereas if you have sort of a robotic assistant helping you, that it actually has a lot of these extra added benefits because it's sort of not human.
And until we reach the actual sort of social intelligence or emotional intelligence, that robot is not going to have broken up with their boyfriend the night before and in a bad mood. They're not going to, you know, roll their eyes when you ask them to pass you the book again.
But I think with those kind of findings, it's important to look at the overall aspect of how we come about with those results, because, you know, a lot of senior people, they like to have a certain sense of independence. So being able to do something by themselves, such as commanding a robot to help me do something by myself without the help of a nurse, that's very important to them. But I don't think we can just kind of jump that result into saying, oh, the elderly population actually prefers robotic assistance versus nurses or human nurses.
It does raise an interesting question, though, about the purpose of the different sort of, I guess, schools of thought on robotics. And, you know, Dom's kind of mentioning sort of like the German idea here of they fulfill a function. You know, maybe they build cars, maybe they go into volcanoes, they do dangerous things. And then you have this idea of more interactive robots. They're companions. They help you get your groceries, they clean your house.
Childcare.
Mm-hmm. And it's a different philosophy depending on how we interact with these. I mean, you're going to, you know,
Anthropomorphize.
Thank you. Robots that are in your house cleaning and doing your dishes than you are, you know, the big metal arm in the Ford factory that puts a windshield on a car. So it's going to impact, depending on what culture and how you're interacting with them, it's going to impact on what you think a robot is going to require down the road in terms of rights and just sort of where you see as a proper role for them in our society.
On the other hand, it might depend on what your position is, because I can imagine that someone who is sort of the foreman, if you will, of the robots in the Ford plant might have a lot more anthropomorphization going down for the Ford robots than you might driving your Ford.
Well, sure. I mean, it depends on your individual role with the machines, right? Mm-hmm. If you're the guy who maintains them, mm-hmm. you're probably going to be like, oh, that's my arm. That's, you know, that's Dave arm.
Dude, everyone names their cars and boats.
Right? So, I mean, but I think there's a huge difference, though, when it's not just an arm. It's a human-shaped thing that's in your house, and you come home from work and you say, hi, robot. The robot says, hi, how is your day? Even if that's pre-programmed, it's a very different psychological impact.
Well, and especially when you start talking about, I know that there have been some designs, I don't know a lot about them, but sort of preliminary things for things like childcare. And at that point, you're now actually influencing human development with the nature of the artificial intelligence.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I should mention is that the anthropomorphization factor that you just mentioned, it's actually higher for the older population as well as children.
Mm-hmm.
So as adults, we kind of understand that they're just machines, and we know the ins and outs of it, or some people do anyways. And whereas for the senior population as well as children, there's not the fullest understanding of the workings of the machine. So they're more prone to kind of treat them as persons or something similar to persons. And there's a lot of ethical implications to that, because in a sense it's there's a sense of deception with them. So mm-hmm. one of the robots that are selling quite well these days is it's called Pyro, which is a therapy robot for senior care centers, usually used for people with dementia, used for calming their stress levels and stuff like that. And it has been proven effective for short-term studies at least. What does it do? So it's a really cuddly, cute baby seal.
Oh, yes. I've heard of it.
Yeah, but I've interacted with one once, like a couple years ago.
And did it make you smile?
Absolutely. And it just makes these really cute cooing noises, and it moves, and it blinks its big eyes, and you just can't help but just stare at it and want to pet it and play around with it. And we're putting these robots into the labs of senior people, and they obviously anthropomorphize it, and they say things like, I love this robot, and it's next to a pet to them.
Well, it's also playing on something that I don't think we talked about in the show, supernormal stimulation, right? Where you know, the big eyes are really, really cute, and going with what you're saying, in an odd sort of way, and I'm going to be weird here, but we're kind of making these elderly folks addicted to the robot. Because, I mean, it is such a cue in on what we're expecting a robot to be, that you become attached to it. And in a weird sort of way, it's almost...
Yeah.
Well, it's a lot, you know, the same reason why we like puppies with big eyes. It's playing on all the evolutionary... evolutionary psychology is iffy on good days, but it's playing on all of that to make these robots, as Don said, addicting, and it does. It raises some very interesting ethical questions.
So it's the problem is there's that sense of deception that I was just mentioning. You know, you're developing these kind of relationship with this robot, but it's unidirectional. It's never really returned by the robot.
Mm-hmm. Even if it is able to give indication that it might feel the same way, it can't feel presumably the same way we can.
Right. So it displays certain types of emotions, but it doesn't actually have.
Wow, that's like a human sociopath. It's able to mimic human emotion without actually feeling it.
Yeah.
But no. That leads into another thing. I mean, because one, we don't know what's in. I don't know what's in your mind, Jen. So maybe you're both sociopaths. Maybe not. I'm assuming not. But I mean, at a certain point,
not diagnosed anyway.
as we sort of quote unquote train these robots to be more and more emotionally sensitive, isn't there a certain point where you kind of cross where, you know, if you do something that hurts the feelings of the robot, that maybe you actually have hurt the feelings of the robot? You know, I mean, if it acts like a duck, it quacks like a duck, maybe at some point it actually has become a robot.
Which comes right back to our original sort of opening of, you know, how do you define consciousness? Is it the external sort of trappings of that, or is there something that you actually have to define internally? Because how do you define, again, those hurt feelings?
But this is more philosophy. In your industry, does anyone ever sit there and talk about, in the future, should we be worried about what potential... Like, I mean, if I have a Tickle Me Elmo, and I have used my Tickle Me Elmo, everyone's going to say, yes, well, it's just a doll. But, I mean, if you have your pyro, right, and pyro becomes more and more and more sensitive to it, isn't there a certain point that if I'm always putting it in a negative state, that I'm somehow not a good person? If
well,
only that.
It's interesting you say that, because we, as normal human beings, we don't like to do things that hurt other people or other beings. And there was a test at MIT that looked at just that. So they brought in these children, and they got them to play around with this robotic toy, which when you flipped it upside down, then it would say, oh... I think it's something negative. I don't like it. I'm scared. They compared how long the children would be able to stay hold the robotic toy upside down versus how long can people the same children do it with a mouse or a Barbie doll. Obviously, with a Barbie doll, not a very intimate thing. So they just held it upside down as long as their arms weren't very tired. With a rat, I think it was only a few seconds.
Mouse.
Rats would be really heavy.
Sorry. Yeah. and then with the robot, it was closer to the mouse. I think that was the finding. Mm-hmm. So it goes back to the sense of how do we treat these kind of mechanical beings and our negative emotions that develop by our treatment of the machines. It's already out there.
Well, you know, there are similar lines of argument in the notion of sort of video games. And this idea of playing, say, extremely violent video games, mm-hmm. what does that form of entertainment say about the person playing it? You know, if you have someone who's playing a shooter game and they want to go out and shoot people and they play this video game, you know, if we sort of extrapolated that to sort of robotics, what if you had, say, robotic deer, mm-hmm. and you were allowed to go out and hunt them or something? You know, like, there's a certain point where we start to wonder about the motives of the person who's actually engaging either the robot or, in this case, video games. And I wonder if that is, you know, it's going to be something that we're going to start to see maybe in, I wouldn't want to say sort of legal terms, but perhaps in regulations about, you know, what you can make a robot do, or do to a robot.
Right. So we don't really have that kind of regulation out there yet, regulations mm-hmm. out there, which is one of the problems, because all these issues are now being really widely talked about, which is great, but there's no real regulations out there to kind of tell the engineers, okay, do not develop these kind of robots, or robots that do X, Y, Z. And we actually, I think we actually need them at an international level at that too, because you can make these robots and sell them abroad, you know, no problem. So yeah, part of what I want to do for the rest of my research career at least is to kind of develop that awareness and actually see that establishment of regulations happen. Yeah.
Cool.
All right, then. Well, we're running out of time here on Radio Free Thinker, so why don't we go to our skeptical highlights?
I have one skeptic highlight this time, kind of a spin-off of Ethan's comment on the weekend. Climate corruption, the smart people and big money behind the campaign to deny global warming. It's a talk that's going on Thursday, October 27th at the YMCA Vancouver Program Center. That's 535 Thornby. Tickets are $25, so this is not for the poor among us. Quote, Against overwhelming evidence of dangerous changes in our climate, scientists say we have done much too little to save ourselves from the certain threat. Yet political foundations in Canada and British Columbia are backing away from even their admittedly inadequate targets. This is no accident. For more than two decades, some of the richest companies and foundations in the world have promoted a policy to confuse and deny denial in the climate debate. In their award-winning book, Climate Cover-Up, investigative journalist Richard Little and David Suzuki Foundation Chair James Hogan point fingers and name names. In this lecture, Littlemore will bring the exposure of wrongdoers home to Vancouver and offer an inoculation against the muddled and corrupt thinking that characterizes Canadian journalism and our current political debate. So I thought it was interesting, inoculations this time of year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We can do a whole show about that, but...
They should review how wording of their event can bias and prime people going into it to assume certain things.
I'm sure this is going to be quite open, Farron.
Exposure of wrongdoers. Yeah. Beware wrongdoers. Okay. My skeptical highlight is CITR's fund drive is coming up in the week of November 17th. And for about a week after that. We at Radio Thinker will, of course, be encouraging listeners to call in and donate some money to help us here at CITR. And we'll have some unique skeptical prize packs, so start thinking about what you can give to help CITR.
And if there are any, quote-unquote, corporate donors out there who want to supply us with something to give away as prizes for the fund drive, please let us know, because we looking for swag. Swag is a fancy term for stuff we give you when people donate. Looking for swag to give to people. So if you have something that you think, you know, would be a good prize for someone who donates, let us know and we might include that in our swag and appreciate any offers that would come our way.
Absolutely. So just keep your eye out for that. We'll be reminding you many times over the next few weeks.
And one final time I'll say it and then I will shut up. Come see the Café Scientifique tonight at the Railway Club downtown to hear yours truly talk about MTB, cholesterol, and the exploration of a biochemical field.
Excellent. Well, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
And Jenna saying the real world, or that that's mimicked by robots, is amazing.
Oh, smooth one. Did you want to say goodbye?
Oh, yeah. Thanks for having me. This was Ajahn.
All right. Stay tuned, everybody. And stay tuned for sports, I suppose.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 million.